There's roles, but they're not that interesting, and they're more importantly, they're not with our peers. That's what bugs me the most, is that my male peers that I've grown up with in this business have basically forsaken working with me.
Elizabeth Banks has a bone to pick with actors who won't work with her now that she's over 40, and the Charlie's Angels filmmaker challenges the idea that women can't direct action movies. And Flea wrote a memoir about his troubled childhood before launching the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
For me, kind of the emotional center and the thing that I talk about in the book the most is my relationship with Walter, my stepdad, because he was this terrifying man, but he was also a brilliant musician.
And comedian Gabriel Iglesias reunites with the high school teacher who changed his life. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn, and on this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do, and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, how a 19-year-old filmmaker named Philip Eumanns not only grabbed a top prize at the Tribeca Film Festival, but also landed a distribution deal with Ava DuVernay. But we'll start today with musician and bassist Michael Peter Balzari. You probably know him as Flea. As a teenager, Flea met Anthony Kiedis, Hillel Slovak, and Jack Irons at Fairfax High. Together, they formed the Red Hot Chili Peppers in the 1980s, and the rest is history. In addition to his work as the bassist for the Chili Peppers, Flea is also an actor. You might remember his role as Needles in Back to the Future.
What's the matter? Chicken?
Or as one of the nihilists in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, he believes in nothing.
Later this month, he has a small part in a new movie written by Lena Waithe and directed by Melina Matsoukas.
It's called Queen and Slim. Incredible script.
But Flea wasn't really here to talk about acting. He was here to talk about his new memoir. It's called Acid for the Children. And it's about his wild days before forming the Chili Peppers.
Are we interviewing right now?
Yeah, we're rolling, man.
Can I take one moment before we start? Sure. I have this ritual that I do before I do an interview.
Absolutely.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry, call me superstitious, but I do it every time.
That's good.
Okay, yeah.
What's the ritual? Or is
it's
it,
a prayer.
Can you not talk about it? We took a brief pause, and then we launched in. And Flea started with the event that would change the course of his life.
When I was a kid, my father was a very strict man. He, you know, ran the house in a very kind of militant, ship-shaped way. Everything was wholesome. We had dinner every night at 7. He wore a suit, had a briefcase, went to work every day. Very, you know, very normal. And, you know, we came from Australia to America because we were an Australian family. We were in New York for 4 years while he completed his assignment at the Australian consulate. And then we were to return to Australia where we were going to live our Australian lives. And my mom, my wild-ass, heart-following, irresponsible mom, took off with a junkie jazz musician who lived in his parents' basement. We left my dad. He went back to Australia without us. And we moved into this life and everything flipped upside down. I mean, everything.
So what is it like to go back there? Because what you're doing in a book is you're excavating the memories about the physical things that happened, but attached to those physical things are emotional feelings about what is happening in and around your life.
Absolutely.
And I think of some stories. I think it's a Halloween story involving your stepfather. Mm-hmm. So when you're recalling these events, how much do you think about your state of mind at that time? Do you have new perspective on how you became the person you are as you're starting to revisit and write down all of these memories?
All of that in spades. You know, it's when I was actually doing the writing, I just wanted to be artful about it, but I didn't really have the emotional impact. Firstly, I would read it to my editor often. I'd write all my stuff, and I would read it to him, and while I was reading, invariably I would start sobbing. And when I did the audiobook, it was just like, it was just a sob fest, man. It was really emotional. For some reason, I can write it and it's cool. Like, I just want to write it well and really describe what I'm feeling and try to, you know, do a good job. But when I read it out loud, it's very emotional. But anyways, like, yeah, that particular event, it was Halloween and I was out trick-or-treating with some friends right at the end. Like, I was getting too old to trick-or-treat. I think I was 13, maybe 12. And we ran into all these other kids, these trick-or-treaters we knew from school, and they're all running home. And they're like, there's a crazy guy in the street. He's shooting a gun. He's berserk. Everyone's scared. Everyone's going home. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to get home. And I, you know, we all my friends split up and run in different directions. No one wants to get shot. And I'm running home, and I get home, and I see, like, all debris in my front yard. The windows busted out. Like, the TV had flown through the windows in the yard. And I'm like, I didn't register it. I just ran inside the house, and then I see my stepdad there, and I realize as soon as I walk in, oh, he's the gun shooting madman. He's the lunatic that everyone's terrified of. And it was sort of this combination of absolute terror of what was he going to do next, because he was sitting there slumped on the couch, like in his underwear and his blood and guns. And I was also embarrassed because everyone, it was my house. You know, it's funny because, you know, I've been doing press for this book, and you know, a big part of my child is when I meet Anthony Kiedis, we end up starting at Chili Peppers. And it's a, you know, it's a very important relationship in my life. But for me, and I'm just kind of saying this now, thinking about it, like kind of the emotional center and the thing that I talk about in the book the most is my relationship with Walter, my stepdad. Because he was this terrifying man, but he was also, I mean, he was a brilliant musician. He was a jazz bass player. He was an absolutely ferocious musician, and he'd play this upright bass, and when he played it, he attacked his instrument with like a violent frenzy, you know, these fast bebop walking bass lines. But he was taking all his torment and turning it into something beautiful through his bass. And even though, like, when I got older and I thought I was rebelling against him by playing rock music, I was doing exactly what he showed me to do. And it's what I still do to this day. All my feelings of pain, loneliness, feeling misunderstood, whatever it is, it's always being exercised through whatever art form I'm privileged to use as a vehicle, and namely playing the bass.
And you also write about hearing him and some of his bandmates jam, I think, in your apartment when you were a kid, and it's transformative.
Yeah, I just threw myself on the floor and started rolling around and laughing and yelling out crazy stuff. And the thing is, I wasn't trying to be funny or silly. Like, you know, kids are funny and they're wild and they act up. And I was prone to that as well. But the music was literally hurling me around on the ground. I just was like in such ecstasy. It changed everything for me.
We're talking with Flea. His new book is called Acid for the Children. I want to play another jazz musician. This song is called A Night in Tunisia. I think you recognize the player?
Yeah, man. The crystal clear sound cutting a hole in the sky, man. That's Dizzy Gillespie.
So tell us about your encounter with Dizzy.
You know, I had started playing the trumpet in seventh grade, and I fell in love with it. And my hero was Dizzy Gillespie. He had this magical trumpet. His cheeks puffed up when he played. He was funny. He dressed wild. He was smart. He was everything that I saw as a great person could be. He was my hero. My mother took me to see him play at Royce Hall at UCLA. I believe it was 1973. I was 12 years old. And we're sitting in the audience at Royce Hall waiting for Dizzy to come on. And I was like, when's he coming, Mom? When's he coming? When's he coming? She's just, you know, he's coming. Don't worry. And I got to the bathroom, and I jump up to go pee. I run out. I run down the aisle. And instead of going back to the lobby where you're supposed to go to the bathroom, I was just excited and ran towards the stage and just saw a door and ran in it looking for the bathroom. I run in. There's people walking around, and I'm by myself. I'm looking. There's Dizzy Gillespie standing there holding his horn, his magic horn with the bell that pokes up to the heavens. I run up to him in total awe. Mr. Gillespie, Mr. Dizzy, I can't speak. I'm just so in awe that it's him. And he pulls me in and kind of like hugs me with his arm, so my head's up in his armpit and I'm cuddled up next to him. And he just kind of holds me there. And he's holding his horn in one hand. He's holding me in the other hand, embracing me in this like loving embrace, speaking to somebody. And I'm just in heaven, you know. I'm sitting there, and to this day, I remember the feeling of him, like the smell of his cologne, his suit, his everything about it. Like, and he was so kind. So sweet, man. And anyway, he keeps talking to this guy for a few minutes, and then He stops talking to the guy, kind of looks down, just smiles at me, pats me on the head, walks on stage, starts playing Night in Tunisia. And I'm just, forget all about peeing, you know. And I run back to my mom, and I was just so happy, and it was such a beautiful thing. Yeah, and that's Diz.
I'm going to play another piece of music. Okay. This is probably my favorite song by a band that I think you and I both love.
Sometimes I grow so tired.
So we've got jazz, we've got Dizzy, and then we've got Led Zeppelin. At what point do those different forms of music start to coalesce in your mind as a way to bridge what you've heard your stepdad play on the bass, what Led Zeppelin's doing, and how you can move into rock and roll?
What happens is I meet a boy named Hillel Slovak. And, you know, at this point, I had grown up in such a jazz household. I adopted the jazzer's attitude of a disdain for rock music. I thought it was music for people who just wanted haircuts and silly magazines and clothes. They didn't really care about music. I saw it as like a de-evolution of what music is capable of, which was an arrogant stand for a 13-year-old, 14-year-old boy, whatever, how old I was to take, but that was where I was at. And I meet Hillel, and he's just this beautiful, artistic poet of a kid. You know, he writes, he makes these beautiful paintings, he plays guitar, and he's in love with rock music, and he's in love with the whole romancing rock stardom, the whole thing. And I'd already become friends with Anthony. We were very close. We meet Hillel, we become a threesome. And I start falling in love with rock music. I see them play. There's no teachers. There's no one around. Girls come and watch, and they want to see because it's cool. And we're in a room, and they're playing. I watch them play, and I start softening towards it. Music becomes less like notes and learning the complex harmonic ideas than just like this fun, wild, awesome thing, you know? And I start playing. And, you know, shortly after that, Hillel asked me to start playing the bass, and that happens.
We're talking with Flea. His new book is called Acid for the Children. I want to ask you to read something from the book. It's in front of you. It's page 143.
Can I use your reading glasses?
They're not reading glasses.
Are there any reading glasses around?
I don't know.
Because I always
Let's
have
see.
Them, and I was in such a rush to come here that I didn't bring
Let's
them.
Let's see. It's oh, my God. Look what Jesus put in your pocket.
The gods want me to read this.
So it starts on page 143. Then there was Freddie Gold.
Then there was Freddie Gold. His two older sisters were both friends with my sister at Hollywood High. Freddie was my first rich friend. When I went over to his house, I discovered an opulence previously unknown to me. A big spread up in the West Hollywood Hills, in the Bird Streets, up above the Sunset Strip, including the famous Blue Jay Way. There's a fog upon L.A., and my friends have lost their way. That's a Beatles song. A big swimming pool, two well-stocked refrigerators, a Salvadorian housekeeper named Bessie in a white suit and hat, everything clean, immaculate white shag rugs, a massive aquarium that bubbled its modern convex way out of the black-tiled wall. Freddie always had weed. We'd smoke it, go in his pool, then the sauna, listening to loud music. The popular stuff, which being a jazz nerd, I knew very little about. Peter Frampton, P-Funk, Led Zeppelin, living it up.
What's interesting about the Freddie Gold story is this idea about class and privilege. You are essentially a latchkey kid. You are on your own, left to your own devices, and you have this friend or these friends who have a different life that you have a glimpse of. How do you think that starts to affect the way you see the world and the way you navigate your way around the things that you don't have?
Yeah, well, one interesting quick aside to that question is that the world was so different then here in the early 70s, because now if a parent has any money, you're going to a private school. But back when I went to the LA public schools, we had every class of kid. That doesn't exist in public school now. I had kids who were poor, whose mothers were streetwalkers. I had kids who, like Freddie Gold, were wealthy. And crazily enough, like, I liked, you know, the yummy food. They had a swimming pool. We could go jump in the pool, go in the sauna. But I didn't covet it. I treasured my connection with my other friends, you know, who I had profound relationships with, who had nothing. So it wasn't really about that for me. But it wasn't the nothing. The nothing that we had was the nothing because we had no peace or harmony in the home. It was our home was a scary home to be in, you know. The things that I wanted to do well at didn't revolve around making money. It was never like, I'm going to make money. I'm going to get this. I'm going to do that. It was more like, I'm going to be a badass on this trumpet. I'm going to wear a suit like Dizzy Gillespie and blow my horn.
Flea's memoir is called Acid for the Children. You can also see him in Queen and Slim, which is out on November 27th. Flea, thanks so much for coming in.
Okay, and just so you know, I'm not recommending that children take LSD. This is a poetic
This is
statement.
A cautionary tale in many ways.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Two years ago, the comedian Louis C.K. admitted to disturbing and unwelcome sexual behavior in front of a number of women after the New York Times detailed his misconduct. The cable channel FX, where Louis C.K. was an executive producer of four shows, cut ties with him, and he stopped performing stand-up, but not for long. Now Louis C.K. is on a comedy tour. Glenn Whipp covers entertainment for the LA Times, and he went to see what Louis C.K. had to say now that he's back on stage.
He does address what happened, you know, and the audience is very much on his side, you know, that he's had a rough couple of years, and that if you ask a woman if it's okay to jerk off in front of her, and she says yes, don't do it. Ask again, and if she still says yes, don't do it because it's not popular. Not don't do it just because it's not the right thing to do. Don't do it because, you know, you might get in trouble and you might lose your ability to have comedy specials and a TV show and headline Madison Square Garden.
You saw him perform in Raleigh, North Carolina, and you wrote, and I'm quoting now, "If anything, he's even more aggressive these days in exploring and assaulting societal norms and boundaries." Let's talk about retarded people, he says early on in his set. Does it feel that, in fact, he's dialing it up as opposed to dialing it down?
It does feel like he's dialing it up in the sense that his comedy before this investigation came to light, there is always, I think, a running element of decency, that he was trying to be a good dad, he was trying to be a good human. Yeah, he has all these horrible thoughts, but he's trying to push them away and be a good human being. And now that effort to be a good human being doesn't seem to be coming across as much. He's just expressing a lot of horrible thoughts.
Louis C.K. used to play huge venues. He's now playing smaller clubs. And it sounds like from your story, tickets are about as cheap as they are to a minor league baseball game in the Inland Empire. So where is he playing in terms of this tour? And is the ticket price kind of a reflection that people are not that eager to go see him?
Well, he's selling tickets. I saw him twice in Richmond, Virginia, and, you know, this small, like 1,800 seat theater downtown. And then I saw him at a performing arts center in Raleigh. And the Raleigh show didn't sell out. You could still find tickets to it. I mean, I bought a ticket for the first show for $4. Like for the Raleigh show, you could go on this Vivid Seats, which is a reseller like StubHub, and you could buy two seats orchestra level for $9 a piece. So it seemed to indicate to me for these early part of the tour that ticket resellers had snapped up a lot of the tickets and nobody was buying them.
We're talking with Glenn Whipp at the LA Times about the comedian Louis C.K. You talked to some people and took notes outside of the venue. What did they say about why they wanted to hear Louis C.K.? And how would you describe the demographic mix of the people who were attending his show?
I guess about 70-30, male to female. I mean, I ran into this guy, and he was in the beginning of my story, who had flown down from New York. And he had bought two tickets, and he couldn't find anyone to go see the show with him. And he went to a hotel across the street that had a bar, and he was trying to sell the ticket or find at least somebody to go with him. He had told me that he had approached a woman that he knew, a longtime friend, and asked her over lunch, "You want to go see Louis C.K. with me?" And he said that that almost ended the friendship, just him asking her that. So he's very much still a sensitive subject.
Glenn Whipp is the entertainment columnist at the LA Times. Glenn, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
After a short break, in Hollywood, Elizabeth Banks is an actor, director, writer, and producer. At home, she has a different job.
I have two young sons, and I am in charge of what they watch because I'm their mom, right? I make them watch Frozen, and I make them watch movies and television shows starring women and girls.
That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. I've seen gypsies. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame Weekend.
Good morning, angels.
Good morning, Charlie.
This Charlie's Angels remix from Black Caviar is the theme to the newest installment in the female crime-fighting franchise. It all began back in the 1970s with the iconic TV show that starred Farrah Fawcett, Kate Jackson, and Jacqueline Smith. Among the fans back then was a young Elizabeth Banks.
I understand when a woman especially takes on action that that is going to cause a stir, and it's partly why I wanted to do it, for sure.
Banks wrote, directed, produced, and co-stars in the new film. She plays the Bosley character, and after it had a disappointing opening weekend at the box office, she tweeted this: "Well, if you're going to have a flop, make sure your name is on it at least four times. I'm proud of Charlie's Angels and happy it's in the world." Elizabeth Banks has known big success as a director. She made the 2015 film Pitch Perfect 2. It took in nearly $300 million worldwide. Both that movie and Charlie's Angels involved stories of sisterhood, but with Charlie's Angels, there was something more.
Most importantly for me as a young woman whose mom had a job and who knew she was going to grow up and have a job was that I was watching professional women on TV looking fabulous in a really cool, exciting job. They didn't go to a desk every day. You know, we had a lot of sitcom moms. We had a Mary Tyler Moore. But this was like fabulous butt-kicking women working together. And I just knew I was watching something that felt very revolutionary to me.
It also felt like in the original series, as in your movie, these women are underestimated, not only because they're women, but also because they're beautiful.
Yeah, and I address that in the opening
scene
of Charlie's Angels, that exact idea. I got to play with a lot of expectations in the opening scene of the movie, one of which is the audience's expectation for what Kristen Stewart can do in a movie like this. And she presents as a sort of Barbie doll in pink and long blonde hair, and she's in a sort of what we come to figure out is a honey trap, which is a nice trope of these kinds of movies that I wanted to like use and throw out immediately. And she's talking about how if women are beautiful, that's all that's really expected of them. And if they're not, they're essentially rendered invisible. And invisibility and low expectations are superpowers when it comes to being a female spy. So she's basically acknowledging exactly why honey traps still work.
And there's a line of dialogue that her character has, and I don't know if it's 7 seconds, but that
yes,
men don't recognize a threat 7 seconds later when it's coming from a woman,
yes,
than it's coming from a guy.
That was based on research that they did of a guy. If they sat a man in a chair in the middle of a room and they had a man walk in with a gun, and immediately that man was like, whoa, okay. Then a woman walks in with a gun, same scenario, and the guy goes, huh, what are you doing with that gun? What's going on? At that point, you're shot. It was incredible that we're just not considered threatening. And what a great advantage that we have then.
I want to ask you about a small scene, and it's a glimpse, and if you don't pay attention, you might miss it in Charlie's Angels. There's a scene where one of your characters is meeting with somebody who is running some sort of NGO in Turkey, mm-hmm. and there's a truck of supplies.
Yes.
And if you look really closely, the supplies are feminine hygiene products.
Correct. Again, I want to play with tropes of spy movies, so the whole information exchange is usually a bag of money or a cache of weapons. And in this case, I was reading about the female interpreters that help our military in war-torn areas around the world and how we sort of pay for those women or help those women. And they, I was reading about the fact that they say, if you give us money, the men in our lives can just take it from us. And what we would spend that money on is our families and ourselves and our health. And so can you just give me tampons? Like, I just love the idea that in the world of Charlie's Angels, that we would pay for information with tampons and birth control because that's what women actually need. And it was about, again, expanding the sense of sorority around the world, which is that women have to stick together because otherwise they take it from us.
We're talking with Elizabeth Banks about her new movie, Charlie's Angels. Did you have an idea of the audience that you were making this film for while you were making it?
Yeah, of course.
How would you define it? No, but is it male and female? Is it younger?
Let me be clear. I have two young sons, and I am in charge of what they watch because I'm their mom, right? Which means I get to let them watch Frozen, and I make them watch movies and television shows starring women and girls. Dora the Explorer comes to mind. These are things that I think are really important to create more empathy in male moviegoers, because as I was growing up, I was given Harrison Ford in 12 different franchises, and I grew up wanting to be Harrison Ford because the women in Harrison Ford movies don't really do all that much. And I thought I would like to do the things that Harrison Ford is doing. And so now I'm trying to, I'm just trying to understand the systemic issues that are affecting why men don't go watch women do things that women can absolutely do in movies.
Yeah, if they don't watch that, then they don't believe it, because
right.
those kinds of influences are incredibly important in terms of how you start to see the world.
That's exactly right.
There's another thing that happens, and that is that at a certain age, and it seems to get younger and younger every year, that a female actor is not considered for certain parts, whereas a guy can play, you know, he can play 20, he can play 50, that there's a switch that's flipped really early on. And again, it's back to the same conversation about not imagining somebody at a certain age doing anything other than what has been prescribed by history.
Absolutely. I mean, look, the thing that I see happening is that when women turn 40, we essentially stop working with our peers. Our male peers start working with 25-year-olds, which is great for those 25-year-old women. I'm glad to be starting they're all starting their careers. But what happens to us is we work alongside our peers for 15, 20 years of our careers, and then they go, thanks, see you later, and they go work with younger women. And this is, it means that for us, when you just talked about how the studios are developing tons of movies for men, they're not doing it for women. Okay, so now they've developed the movies for men, and they've also said, when we put that movie together, you're not going to be in it because you're too old now, essentially. These men want to seem virile and sexy. They want to work with young female actresses. So suddenly, as Reese Witherspoon said, she's looking around going, there's roles, but they're not that interesting. And they're more importantly, they're not with our peers. And that's what bugs me the most, is that my male peers that I've grown up with in this business have basically forsaken working with me.
That's devastating.
It's devastating.
Because you're their age.
Correct.
That's really bad.
I don't know if anyone's ever pointed this out to you.
No, you
seem a little shocked.
No, it has certainly been pointed out, but that people that you have worked with, in so many words, would say, it's not happening anymore.
This is the thing. They're not saying it. It's just happening, right? So that's the thing. It's like,
well,
I feel like it just
themselves.
Has to be pointed out because I feel like I have to point it out.
No, it's not news to me. It's what is amazing is that it's just so intentional.
It is.
Okay, I want to ask you about Hoo Ha Ha, because this seems to be something that is very important to you.
We at Hoo Ha Ha are teaming up with YouTube Space for the Women in Comedy Initiative. We're going to spotlight the funniest up-and-coming women around the world.
Hoo Ha Ha is a community, more than anything, of content creators who are all women and who are mostly funny. And it was sort of came out of this Vanity Fair article that I read many years ago, in which it was posited that it was impossible for women to be as funny as men, which I just think is silly because, you know, Lucille Ball existed. Tina Fey exists. So it can be proven false on its face nearly immediately. But these are the narratives that get written when the people in charge let men write the articles.
Elizabeth Banks, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Banks is the writer, director, and producer of Charlie's Angels. She also plays Bosley in the movie. It's in theaters now. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. If you were to watch the Netflix series Mr. Iglesias with comedian Gabriel Iglesias, you may not know that there's some true life going on in there. He plays a high school teacher who fights for students who are struggling.
So many people have turned their backs on these kids, and I don't want to be one of those people.
We're not turning our backs on them. It's turning our faces to the good students.
Look, Hernandez may think that these kids are invisible, but I see them. All of them.
The show is set at Wilson High in Long Beach, which happens to be where Iglesias attended school in the 1990s. He dedicated the first episode of Mr. Iglesias to his real-life high school speech teacher, June Garner, writing, "Thank you for believing in me when I didn't believe in myself." As part of our ongoing series that reunites creative types with the teachers who changed their lives, KPCC arts education reporter Carla Javier tagged along with Gabriel Iglesias when he recently met up with June Garner.
Hi, June.
Hiya.
They want me to walk in all surprised, okay? So you can evaluate my acting.
They began with how Iglesias first ended up in June Garner's speech class.
I got kicked off the football team for being a little too vocal. Yeah. So I was out, and then next thing I know, I'm looking to see, like, well, what can I get into? Speech? Well, I got kicked out for talking too much. Maybe I'll be celebrated in this area.
And you were.
And I was.
When you first started though in class, you spoke like a rocket. You would do it all really fast, and we had to work on you slowing down. But I'll tell you, you're the most successful person I can think of that ever came out of the California High School Speech Association. And you were cutting edge because you were one of the very first people to incorporate Spanish and English. And I was so proud of you for that, you know, because that wasn't done. I mean, you really started the trend of doing total humor in that event.
It was a routine, a bunch of characters thrown into a blender. A lot of the characters and stuff is what I used the very first time I went on stage and called myself a comic. You know, you got to figure from the time that I finished high school, 94... I went up on stage April 10th of 97. My act was my speech from high school. And I would only go up there for like 5 minutes, 5 minutes at a time until I build it up. And I was fast then too. People would always tell me, dude, you slow down. It was all nervous energy.
Remember what I used to always say about nervousness? Nervousness is just excitement misunderstood.
Huh, yeah.
You know?
You know, people always ask, you know, so what is it that you learned? About it, what didn't I learn? You're probably the only class that I really focused and paid attention in. Just because, and not that I was a difficult student, but I was easily distracted or annoyed by most teachers. You were fearless as far as just people walking in. You had no problem calling it like you saw it and just saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. And if you're into it, you're into it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take no.
Yeah. And then this Netflix thing, I've only watched your first season probably about 12 times. I needed something to give me joy in my life at this point. Mm. I'm not going to cry. But
not.
Watching you, I don't know, I'm just so proud of you.
Gabe, we are a public school. Our funding depends on meeting certain standards, grades, discipline, attendance levels.
And the easiest way to improve those averages is to counsel out the kids who are hurting the numbers.
What do you call this program? Some Children Left Behind?
I don't hate it.
This program could make our school the educational pearl of the district.
Yeah. I gotta do a swipe left on a bunch of kids.
I thought, well, this is really good.
Believe it or not, this is not the first time I dedicate something to you. My first Comedy Central half-hour special that I did in New York, I had written a dedication to you on it. Mm. I know it's there, and if you pause it, you can catch it.
That's
but,
so sweet.
You know, we had lost touch, and, you know, that it was the least I could do was at least acknowledge the fact that you were that influential.
At your premiere, this one man came up to me, and he said, I just want to thank you for giving Gabriel to the world. And I said, I didn't give Gabriel to the world. He gave himself to the world, and isn't it great? You know, and he said, no, but I saw the dedication. And I said, he would have done it anyway, whether I was there or someone else was lucky enough to have been walk into that classroom. You know, I just always felt so lucky to work with you. And I feel that way about a lot of people, but it's just so extraordinary. I mean, you're known around the whole world.
Scary.
I think it's awesome, you know?
Once you get over there to the studio, your name's on everything. There's a parking spot as soon as you pull in. It's got my name on it. It's all cool.
Oh, that's so cool.
There's a security officer there to tow someone if somebody...
God.
Like, yeah. You know, you go to craft services, your name's all over everything. What do you want? It's whatever you need.
God.
We don't have it, we'll get it.
So fun to hear about all this because, you know, I'm just your regular, run-of-the-mill, retired teacher, you know? But to see
all the success. Well, now you got free time to come to the tapings then, right?
I would kill to do that.
You don't have to kill. She don't have to kill.
But I
know a guy.
You know a guy. Okay.
Up next on The Frame Weekend, they're funny, but they're not famous, and they do stand up in front of a live audience every day. Warming up a crowd, that's next on The Frame Weekend. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me on The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. When you watch a sitcom or a talk show or anything with a live studio audience, really, if the audience is laughing, even over a lame joke, that's known as a warm crowd. And that's because somebody warmed them up. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving wanted to find out just who are those people who pump up the crowd.
A few months ago, I got free tickets to a taping of a sitcom pilot starring Hamilton alumnus Leslie Odom Jr. We had to arrive at CBS Studio Center several hours early, go through security, wait, and wait, and wait. We finally get into the studio, sit down, and then this presumably 23-minute sitcom episode took more than 4 hours to tape. The only reason the audience kept laughing take after take was this guy.
Let's see if I can get you guys focused. Let's all try one clap as a group on the count of three. Ready? 1, 2, 3! What the heck? Great energy. She's up there like, "Wah!"
Ron Pearson has been a warm-up comic for 31 years, an unseen but invaluable presence at thousands of hours of American television. This was a recent taping for the Netflix show Fuller House on the Warner Brothers lot.
Listen, this is called a sitcom. It's short for situation comedy. This is different from every other form of television. Listen, in that in a sitcom, you guys are the most important people here. Say what?
Pearson started out as a champion juggler and worked as a street performer in France when he was young.
If you took Cirque du Soleil and stripped it down to maybe 7 or 8 performers and had a storyline and developed clown characters for each person, that's what we were doing. And I didn't speak French, but I learned the whole show in French. Qu'est-ce que tu faisais par terre?
His job as a warm-up is to get the audience in a good mood and laughing. But this isn't a stand-up comedy gig. He's there to establish the rules and keep everyone in line.
Rule number one is if something's funny, what do? Laugh, right? You're here to laugh because we're filming in front of a live studio audience, and literally your laughter will be heard around the world. Pretty cool, huh? Rule number two is just as easy. If you're not sure if it's funny, what do? Right, laugh anyway.
He's there basically to cheerfully guide a bunch of hungry, tired strangers, sometimes huge fans of the show, sometimes a busload from a rehab house, through what can ironically be a tedious, soul-crushing slog.
Sometimes a show has so much energy and so much popularity and so many good stars that I just push the snowball at the top of the hill and the snowball goes. And it builds and builds through the night because the show has so much going on. And then some shows, I'm pushing a boulder up a hill.
Come on!
As the hours drag on, Pearson breaks out the big guns, juggling, perching precariously on the railing, and balancing a full-size ladder on his chin.
You know, you're the court jester. It's your job to keep the energy and the mood light.
It feels like a hostage situation. By hour four, I think I would murder people.
Jimmy Pardo is a stand-up comedian and longtime podcast host. For 6 years, Pardo was Conan O'Brien's warm-up guy, work that's pretty different from warming up a sitcom audience.
And they're still getting up and going, "Who's got a joke? You know, come on, who wants to get it? We got a dance contest going," and they're doing anything they can to keep that energy up. And I admire that because, again, I think I would just walk down if I was on the set of Friends, tell Matthew Perry, go F this, and I'm done.
He says warm-up comics are critical to the machinery of these shows working, but there's historically been a stigma about the work.
I think it's made a turn. I think not unlike cruise ships, like, you know, when your career's over, you went and worked on the cruise ships for old people and so on and so forth, but the cruise ships have taken a turn and they're now hiring hip, relevant comedians. I think the same thing has kind of happened with warm-up. I think it went from guys that you'd go, "Oh, that guy can't work the clubs, so he does warm-up." I think that that's also taken a turn. It's not as frowned upon as it was 10 years ago, even.
Pardo is very funny. He's also very good at playing second or even third fiddle.
Doing warm-up in the settings that I did, which were talk shows that have a human being's name in the title and their stars, my job was to set the table for them and not make it about me. Your job is to be funny and then hand over the baton to the star and let them run with it.
Occasionally, Conan called Pardo over to the couch.
You left my show. You are in my employ. You're supposed to stick around for a while.
And I always do, sir.
Yes, but you left last night, and I'm worried about you. It was a medical emergency. What happened?
What are you, Gladys Kravitz? Who cares what happened to me?
For warm-up comics like Ron Pearson, they may not be in the spotlight of your favorite show, but you'd sure notice if he wasn't around.
A lot of people say, "Oh, all the sitcoms are canned laughter." Well, they're not.
Well, that was embarrassing. Who knew indigestion could feel just like childbirth?
And it ain't easy.
I come home often with splitting headaches up the back of my head, very tired. And by the way, I'm deaf in one ear and 30% deaf in the other. So I talk really loud generally. So I push my voice way too much. I actually text my wife before every show, and I say, "Starting the battle."
And all for the sake of laughter. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Philip Eumanns is only 19, but he has already written and directed his first feature, and it won a top prize at the Tribeca Film Festival, landed him a deal with Ava DuVernay's distribution company, and now it's on Netflix. The film is called Burning Cain, and it's set in Louisiana, not far from where Eumanns grew up in New Orleans. In a lot of ways, it's a personal story for the filmmaker. Burning Cain is largely focused on the influence of the Southern Baptist Church and a particular pastor on a family and a community.
The fact that it's set in rural Louisiana, I think there's a lot of congruencies in the sort of Southern Baptist ethos that my mom told me about in her life growing up in Lowcountry, South Carolina. I think the place and even the environment of shooting also helped craft an interesting place for my actors because we weren't close to New Orleans, at least not. You couldn't just go immediately bop, bop. So we were out there in rural Louisiana, and they really had to sort of breathe in the air of what it meant to really be in Laurel Valley day to day.
Church is another big factor in this story, and there's a couple different perspectives on religion. There's scripture, there's what Malcolm Forbes has to say, which becomes part of a sermon, "He who dies with the most toys wins." And then there's this idea about the devil, that there is this agency beyond our control that is going to make us do bad things without our assuming responsibility for the actions that we ourselves are doing.
Yes. That's the whole thing, man. I feel like oftentimes we'll blame something on some sort of outside force when we're not really reckoning with the evil that may be within us. And that's what I wanted to do, especially with the way the sermons are sort of outlined in the film. Wendell sort of dances around, you know, that scapegoat within those first two sermons, and still ultimately...
This is Wendell Pierce, your lead actor.
Yes, I lead. For Reverend Tillman. Tillman sort of dances around, you know, the evil within us, talking about, you know, in sort of like hinting towards that final sermon where he finally names the devil as this scapegoat, as this emotional scapegoat that he then blames all of our evil doings in.
Pull me away from the power of the Lord. You gotta say, devil, repeat after me, devil.
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 I will not be corrupt.
I will not be corrupt.
Devil.
Devil.
I will not cheat.
Devil.
Devil. I will not lie.
To me, I've always felt like the devil was a sort of emotional scapegoat and someone where we weren't really reckoning with what we were really doing to ourselves and the decisions that we were making on our own accord, you know. And so I definitely wanted to talk about that with Burning Cain, and definitely wanted to sort of outline that within those sermons so that by the end of it, you can see where all of the blame gets sort of left to.
And the problem with growing up in the church or any church and having issues with the theology is that it's impossible for most religions to not look at that person as some sort of apostate, that you can't challenge the beliefs without challenging the underlying doctrine.
Exactly. But I feel like that's why I try to make sure that I make it known that my intention with the piece was not to create a judgmental view of it. It was about humanizing them and creating a sort of objective discussion. I did want it to spur on the conversation of looking at it within our community, but within culture in general, but also within the Black community, sort of really, really dissecting religion and its place in our community, and sort of juxtaposing role that I feel like it has, you know. But it's so interesting, you know, you can talk to especially people who have been following, you know, Christianity their entire lives, and especially with people within my family where I would have disagreements or arguments and questions that wouldn't always get answers. But I understand that it's difficult to reckon with something that you've been following your whole life. You know, and that understanding was something that I also think I sort of developed in time, one with making the movie, but also in having conversations with my family and recognize that I think younger members of my family were more open to having the debate and older members were just shutting it down at the start.
We're talking with Philip Eumanns about his film Burning Cain. So you're drawing on family and friends because of the world in which this story is set.
Yeah.
And depending on your point of view, it may not be a flattering depiction of religion and these characters' relationship to faith. So when you take it back to the people who helped make it and you're showing them a story of your view of the church that is meaningful to them,
yeah,
is that awkward? What kind of conversations happen after they see it?
Well, I was definitely afraid for my family to first see the film at Tribeca. I don't know if I should say afraid, but just nervous because I knew that, you know, they're all very religious. A lot of them came up from South Carolina to see it in New York, and the film showcases religious figures in a distinctly fallible light. The conversations aren't black and white. I think it is a little bit easier for some of my family to sort of stomach my differences, given, you know, some of the positive attention that's come around the film and in my voice, you know, but that it really doesn't end, you know. That's I think they recognize that my intention was to humanize and that I did not want to approach it from a judgmental way, but I also can't lie. Like, I have to live my truth and be honest and say, like, this is not what I believe anymore. And I'm just not going to live in fear on that.
I want to ask you about music, because there is a lot of music and there's some church music in here that you incorporate into the story. At what point are you starting to hear songs? At what point do they influence the way that you're writing your screenplay?
So that was really early on. So I was listening to so much blues music, man. You know, Robert Johnson was probably the biggest artist that I was listening to.
Got the mother than the red heart. Yes, you got myself.
Pretty much the complete recordings was on repeat throughout pretty much most of the writing process. And then when I started getting some more deeper into gospel music before 1970, you know, looking at a lot of early sort of Negro spirituals that were recorded, I found the Mississippi Blue Spring Baptist Delegation. I wanted to actually use one of their songs in the film, but then I discovered Mary Lou Williams, and the place that I was going to use that Mississippi Blue Spring song, Mary Lou Williams and her album Black Christ of the Andes from 1964, totally switched up my whole thinking.
Ye gentle creatures, tame and wild.
There's a song in the film called St. Martin de Porres that I think is one of the most haunting, almost quasi-medieval in a way, sort of choral records.
Ye sheltered, each unsheltered child.
But the music that I was listening to definitely crafted, helped craft the narrative and craft the sort of grit that comes with rural Louisiana, especially with Robert Johnson, and you're thinking about the rural South, it feels sort of just like perfectly congruent.
Philip Eumanns wrote and directed Burning Cane. Philip, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door.
Burning Cane is available on Netflix now. And that's our show for today. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Emily Henderson. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here on Monday for the daily version of The Frame. See you then.